Okay, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jock. This is Deadly Departed. And I have another guest following on from when I was speaking to Dr. Lisa Miller. And we talked a little bit about spiritual science and spiritual awakening. Well, my guest today is, I'd like to say an expert in that, but he also is a professor at university in the UK. And he's written a plethora of books. Just let me just build this up to show you guys as we're going to jump in and speak to Steve. This is Extraordinary Awakenings. And it is an extraordinary book.
Welcome to Deadly Departed. The do's, don'ts, and dangers of afterlife communication. This show discusses all aspects of afterlife communication, grief and grieving, the paranormal, and of course, parapsychology. There's real stories, scientific discussion, and most of all, real learning from paranormal experts and researchers. Here's your host, author of Deadly Departed, renowned evidential medium and spirit interventionist, Jock Brocas.
Steve, welcome to Deadly Departed. How are you?
Hi, Jock. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Now, obviously, we want to talk about, in your book, Extraordinary Awakenings, you have the premise, I think you coined the phrase transformation through trauma.
That's right.
And so how did you come to that? How did you come to, land at that reality?
It was, some of your viewers may be familiar with the term post-traumatic growth, which is a very well-attested and very well-researched concept in psychology. And it shows that when people go through trauma, they often initially suffer from stress and anxiety, but in the long term, they often go through development, positive development. They become more appreciative of their lives. They become more philosophically minded. They live at a kind of deeper level. They uncover a resilience and inner strength that they didn't know they possessed. So that's a sort of gradual process that takes place over many years. But when I interviewed people who'd undergone a spiritual awakening, they often talked about a sudden moment, a specific moment when they underwent a transformation, usually in the midst of intense turmoil. So in some cases, it was a bereavement. In some cases, it was a diagnosis of cancer or a long period of addiction or serious illness, other kinds of serious illness. It could be a variety of different kinds of trauma. But it was almost as if due to the intense turmoil they were undergoing, or it could be like a sudden moment of intense, a shock of stress or tension, Their normal ego seemed to dissolve away and a new kind of innate spiritual self seemed to be born inside them. I coined the term transformation through turmoil as a result of my interviews with these people.
Did you coin it because you saw that there was maybe a missing link from the understanding of post-traumatic growth?
Yeah, I felt that this is, it's obviously a kind of post-traumatic growth, but it's a very radical and very dramatic kind of post-traumatic growth, which hasn't been discussed, as far as I can see, it's not really been discussed in conventional psychology, but it's obviously discussed in spirituality. A lot of people historically have talked about these sudden moments of transformation where they suddenly shift into a different state of being. And, they become reborn. It's a kind of, it's not a religious experience, but it's similar to the kind of born again experience which some religious people describe.
You know, why do you think, Steve, that the role in psychology has not done a great deal of research into that type of transformation? Because I mean, as a psychologist yourself and a lecturer, and been indoctrinated, but engulfed in this world, There has to be some form of kind of disconnect there.
Yeah, I think it's just a little bit far out for conventional psychology. I think conventional psychology has become more open to kind of slightly esoteric, unusual, anomalous phenomena. But something, spirituality is a bit, is a bit of a taboo subject in psychology. And when almost everybody who has this kind of experience, even if they don't have a background in spirituality, which is often the case, that often they don't know anything about spirituality, but they eventually describe it in spiritual terms. They gravitate towards spiritual teachings and books because they instinctively know that that's the best way of understanding the experience. So eventually they start talking in spiritual terms. And yeah, and conventional psychologists have a hard time with spirituality, even though, as I say, I think there's a bit more openness than there used to be.
You also write for Psychology Today. And how have you found that your writing, your articles, not just your books, but your articles? Because it seems to me from many of the articles that I've read of yours, you're not shy on basically challenging the normal concepts in psychology.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. And Psychology Today have been very open, actually. I've been surprised at how open they are to anonymous, even the paranormal. I've written blogs on paranormal subjects, on near-death experiences, after-death communications, and so forth, reincarnation. And they've been surprisingly open, which makes me think that, you know, psychology in general is less narrow and reductionist than it used to be. Same thing's happened in this country, in the UK, where I live, that the British Psychological Society has a magazine called The Psychologist. And I've written a few articles on, you know, on a strange phenomena. We've just finished a debate. I've edited a debate on psi phenomena for The Psychologist, which they're going to publish soon.
So all right, you need to send that to me. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
So
there's definitely more openness than there used to be.
How did you get to this place, Steve? Because obviously, have you always? I mean, there's this old, you know, this old saying. Everybody, I was even in the mediumship world that I'm in, or the psychic world, is I was like this since I was a kid. You know, and I tend to think that's been used so far, you know, over and over. Because I've used it, but not in the same way. Where did you come to this place in your studies, your research in psychology? Was it always an interest?
I've been like this since I was a kid. Sorry to repeat that old adage. But it's true, yeah. Certainly since I was like 16, 17 years old, I sense that I'm the same person now as I was then, with basically the same insights and experiences. But at that time, I just didn't know who I was. I didn't understand myself or accept myself. But I'm basically the same person I always was, you know, from the age of 16 and 17. There was always, from that age, I recognize now that there was a kind of an innate spirituality and an innate interest in anomalous phenomena. I remember actually when I was 16 years old, I went to my local library. And I just sort of wandered around. I was always attracted to books, even as a young child. And I remember this feeling of just being, you know, feeling so contented and fulfilled in this library surrounded by all these books. And I gravitated towards the philosophy and psychology section. And I borrowed three books. I still remember the three books I borrowed now. I borrowed one book on psi phenomena, one book on philosophy, and one book on psychology. And it was as if, you know, and they're the things that I'm interested in now. So it was as if it was always inside me, you know, perhaps something, it was something to do with reincarnation. I don't know. But, you know, I've followed the same path since I was that age.
Wow. So I'll take it on the chin then. So, yeah, you have been like it since you were a kid.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I had spiritual experience ever since I was a kid, but I think the relationship is that we don't know what it is, and we can't label it because we're not understanding it. So there's a lot of people that would say, I always knew I was psychic, and I knew it was this since I was a kid, and I kind of then question that.
Yeah, there's always a struggle. You know, if you're born in a kind of materialistic society.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so there's a struggle to make sense of your experiences within that paradigm.
And also religion, because this is a nice segue into this whole, you know, when we have a traumatic awakening, we have that experience. A lot of people, you know, we've got that term that we all understand, that, well, not everybody understands, but spiritual but not religious, you know, which we seem to drop the attachment to religion from the awakening or the experience that you've had. I mean, it certainly happened to you. I was brought up, as you know, and I spent a lot of my time in a monastery, was heading for a religious life. And my experiences made me question that. Were you like that yourself? Did you have, or were you never, ever connected to religion in any way?
Well, the only religion I was brought up in was football. It was the religion of Manchester United. That was my religion.
Oh, you're a Man United fan. All right. Okay. Well, so yeah, you were like
was a crazy Man United fan. So that, in a sense, that was my religion, you know.
I hate to say this, but I did go and watch the game the other, you know, a wee while ago when Man City absolutely trounced you. And you were, and I was in a pub in Asheville watching the game with my nephew. It was awesome. Oh, well. On the Man City side.
Yeah, from a philosophical perspective, it's just 22 men running around a field chasing a ball. So it doesn't mean very much. I mean, that's it. If you lose, you can take the philosophical perspective and.
Yeah. it doesn't always work like that. But of course, you know, so you've never really been religious at all?
No, I mean, no, there was no religion. My background was totally secular, but not because my parents were atheists. They just weren't, there was just no religion. Yeah. They just weren't interested in religion. And same at school, I didn't know anybody who was religious apart from, there was one Jehovah's Witness and a few Catholic kids. But it wasn't part of my culture. I think it's quite common, you know, sort of.
Yeah.
It was a kind of working class, you know, secular culture in Manchester. But in retrospect, I'm quite grateful for that because, you know, I was able to explore spirituality outside the context of religion. And, you know, obviously, as you must have had this experience that spirituality can exist within religion. It often does.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's particularly in the sort of monastic traditions.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also, you know, many religious people are not particularly spiritual. You know, many religious people behave in a way which is opposed to spirituality.
Antithesis.
Antithetical, that's sort of the word.
Antithetical.
Yeah. So it was a blessing in a way not to have to interpret spirituality within the framework of any particular religion.
Now, what did you experience your own awakening as such?
Well, not really, because I think it was always inside me. But I definitely had spiritual experiences when I was a teenager. They were mainly experiences of communion with nature, ecstatic feelings of connection with nature, and just a feeling of like ecstasy within myself, the feeling that there was this radiant well-being within me that would just sort of immerse me and, you know, override any kind of problems that I had in my life. Mainly it was a feeling of harmony, a sense of meaning, a sense that the whole of nature was alive, was full of consciousness, and everything was interlinked. But it took me a long time. I thought that I didn't understand these experiences at all. I thought it was, you know, they meant I was crazy and that I would never be able to fit into ordinary life.
Yeah, been there.
Yeah. So it was a relief when I was in my 20s and I began to read books about mysticism and spirituality and thought, you know, these are similar to the experiences I've had. So, you know, there are other people who've had these experiences, and suddenly I had a framework to make sense of these experiences.
Did you face any kind of pushback or kickback from when you were in, you know, your academic studies before you became, you know, a doctor, a PhD, before you, as you were going through that? Because obviously you had that within you, and that was the route, you know, the route that you were going down. But of course, you would have had to have been facing pushback from it, because I guess when you were going through it, it wasn't as readily acceptable.
Well, I didn't really interpret it in academic terms. So for a long time, I went to university when I was 18 and studied literature, English and American literature. After that, I had a bad experience. I didn't fit in at all, and I kind of rebelled against academia. So I stayed away from it after that. I was a musician for a number of years, and I kind of drifted from job to job.
Wow.
It was only when I was in my early 30s, years later, that I found out about this field of psychology called transpersonal psychology, and which is basically spiritual psychology. Transpersonal means beyond the ego, as you know.
Yeah.
So it made me, I mean, I'd always been sort of interested in philosophy and psychology and spirituality. So once I found out about transpersonal psychology, I suddenly had this revelation that, wow, this is exactly what I where I belong. This is what I should be doing. So I decided, I found out that there was a master's degree in transpersonal psychology in Liverpool, not far from Manchester. So I thought, wow, this is amazing. So I, you know, immediately applied for the course and met a guy called Les Lancaster, who you know.
Yes.
And he became my kind of mentor, and I did a PhD with him in Liverpool.
Wow. And that's the path I'm on now. I'm just
That's right.
Manifesting that path myself. I remember the first email I sent you. Hey, I can't get into any PhD program. I remember you sending it back to me. So let's talk about a little bit about the book, because in your book, I mean, there's fascinating accounts from people awakening in prison, from grief, from accidents, and from war. As a veteran, you know, myself, I can understand that. How have you, I mean, what made you want to bring this book out?
I over the years, I collected so many amazing and inspiring stories of spiritual transformation. And I met so many people who, you know, they've been through such profound challenges and crises in their lives, but they'd emerged in this sort of higher awakened state, that, you know, it totally amazed me. And it, you know, I just wanted to share some of these stories. And at the same time, I wanted to understand why this seemingly miraculous transformation occurs. But one of the first people I met who was eventually featured in the book was an ex military guy called David, who was in the Navy, the Royal Navy, for about 15 years, I think. And at my university in Leeds, we have a program which we call interdisciplinary psychology, which is a master's degree. And David was one of our students. And I had no idea that he had this background, but he was interested in...
Oh, I remember that in the book.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
He was interested in spirituality and transpersonal psychology. But it was only later on that I found that he'd been in the Navy, in the military for 15 years or so. And he'd had all these transformational experiences through facing death or through the loss of his colleagues and, you know, the constant stress and danger. So, you know, that kind of inspired me to look into similar examples and to collect similar examples. And then I met several people who had recovered from really severe addiction and had undergone an awakening in the aftermath. So at a certain point, I just thought, wow, I've collected so many inspiring stories that they really demand to be shared.
Mm. What do you think is the catalyst to that awakening? Now, I know we, you know, talk about in the book that it's high level stress, something goes on, but what is it? What is that something, that magical switch that really turns that person from either a non-believer to the experience that transforms their life in an instant?
It is almost like a magical switch is a good way of describing it, because in many cases, people can point to one exact moment when they shift. They can pinpoint the exact minute or the remember the day or the hour when it happened. And it was a very tangible moment when something shifted inside them. And it's a transformation that happens in two ways. It can happen through very intense stress or through a longer process of gradual loss. And you can compare it to, I use the metaphor of a house in the book. In a house can collapse in a hurricane in a sudden moment or an earthquake when it just suddenly gives away.
Yeah.
Or a house can collapse over a longer period when you take the bricks away one by one. And eventually, after a certain number of bricks have been taken away, the house will collapse. So sometimes when people go through a very intense period, a very stressful, shocking period, such as when a loved one dies, or it could be just a period of intense stress at work or due to sort of the pressures of family life or whatever, they can suddenly undergo an ego collapse in that particular moment. But in most cases, it happens through a gradual period of losing psychological attachments. So psychological attachments are what kind of sustain our sense of identity. So we can be psychologically attached to hopes for the future, to our sense of status in society, to our possessions,
and it's a root of all. It's a root of suffering as well.
Oh yeah, that's right. And what happens is that when people go through intense turmoil in their lives, whether it's due to addiction or illness or bereavement, perhaps, these psychological attachments are broken down. So people lose their hopes for the future. They lose their sense of identity, their sense of status. They lose their possessions, their relationships. Mm. So eventually everything is taken away and they're reduced to nothing. Their identity is broken down. And that's
would you say, Steve, that that's grief? Sorry? Would you say that that is an aspect, an expression of grief?
Yeah, well, grief is an aspect of that. Yeah, when a person suffers bereavement, you know, the grief is the pain of losing that attachment. And that can lead to, you know, an awakening. Once enough attachments are taken away that the ego can no longer sustain itself as a structure, the ego just dissolves. Yeah. So it's basically ego dissolution. Ego dissolution allows a kind of a dormant or an innate spiritual self to emerge and become and to become a person's new identity.
Do you think, Steve, that you can categorize, if you like, the type of awakening? Because not every individual is going to awaken in the same way. But is there a pattern to someone who's lost a loved one, someone who's been in battle and had that kind of experience, or from an accident or something else? Do you think you can actually categorize the different types of awakening?
Yeah, you can. It's the same basic process which occurs with some slight variations. Like one variation is that it can be, in some cases, it's gradual, or in some cases, it's very sudden, or in some cases, it's a combination of like a few shocks in the midst of a longer gradual process. But essentially,
let's talk about the process. Okay. I'm going to jump back. Sorry for interrupting, but I want to go back in the process because a lot of people will listen to this. And they'll catch on to the idea that you said, oh, yeah, so there's a similar process.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we kind of glossed over that before, but can you let the listeners know what is that process that essentially somebody would go through in the experience of awakening?
Well, there are different ways in which it can occur. I wrote a book called The Leap with the subtitle The Psychology of Spiritual Awakening. And I identified three different ways in which spiritual awakening can manifest itself. The first is when a person is simply naturally awakened. It's their normal, natural state, which they've always had and never lost. Sometimes I suspect that there are certain parallels between the normal childhood state, especially the early childhood state, and the spiritually awakened state, but most people lose those spiritual qualities as they become adults. I think some people retain those qualities and sort of integrate them into their adult state. So they become just normally, naturally awakened. The second way is when spiritual awakening is a very gradual process, which is normally cultivated through certain practices like meditation or by following a path like the monastic path or the path of the Buddhism or the path of the Kabbalah, Sufism, whatever it may be. And then there's the sort of the sudden awakening, which occurs unexpectedly. And usually that's due to intense psychological turmoil. People sometimes talk about kind of spontaneous awakenings that occur for no particular reason. But that's incredibly rare. Usually it's connected to this process of, losing psychological attachments, breaking down the ego.
The ego.
Yeah, ego dissolution. And eventually, there's a certain threshold where the ego can no longer sustain itself or where it just collapses due to the pressure of the situation. And then, once the normal ego dissolves away, there's a space inside a person's being. Often when the ego dissolves away, it's just equivalent to a breakdown. It could be a kind of a psychotic experience. But in some people, it's almost as if there's a kind of dormant, spiritually awakened self, which was always there, and it was always waiting for the opportunity to emerge. Just like a chick, which is ready to hatch from an egg.
Right.
But it's only once the normal ego dissolves away, then it has the chance to emerge, then it has the space to arise. And
do you think that there's some individuals who are maybe overly spiritual, that, you know, haven't got a balance in it, would say that they spiritually awoke, or they had that, as you said, you know, you said there, and I experienced it, just happened, just like that. Do you think it's a case that, you know, the blind leading the blind, really, because there's people that are so caught up with their egos and spirituality that, you know where I'm going, where they're caught up with their egos and spirituality, and all of a sudden they are your instrumental guru for change, and they had this awakening? Because I find that very difficult to deal with or to accept.
Yeah. Yeah, so you mean that you've met kind of narcissistic people who...
Yeah, exactly, where it's, you know, they're so spiritually aware that there's nobody else who's more spiritually aware there, but they would have an awakening, or they've had a realization, and yet, you know, by your own intuition, they're just, this is not, you know... Is it for money? Is it for fame? Is it, you know, is there a hidden agenda to this? Is it really a spiritual awakening, or is something else?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I've met so many narcissistic spiritual teachers over the years, and spiritually orientated people who are all kind of slightly self-deluded and slightly narcissistic. Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, but I think that when people undergo a genuine awakening, then they become pretty much free of conceit and self-absorption.
And you can discern that. You can discern that.
I discern that. Yeah, I can discern that. Not always completely, but largely free. Sometimes it takes a while for negative personality traits to work themselves out. You know,
right.
If you carried a trait for your whole lifetime, it may not dissolve away straight away. It may kind of linger for a while. But I think the problem arises, especially when people have, awakenings can be temporary. You can have experiences of awakening that last a few seconds or a few minutes. I differentiate between awakening experiences, which last for a few seconds or minutes, and the state of being awake, which is an ongoing experience. But sometimes when people have temporary awakening experiences, they think, oh, wow, you know, I've seen the truth. I am enlightened. I am the avatar, you know, but actually, the temporary experience has had the effect of inflating their ego, of inflating their narcissism, it's not integrated into their personality. So that's a danger.
It doesn't last.
It doesn't last. But the kind of the ego inflation which it's created, that lasts, you know, and that becomes encourages them to set themselves up as gurus or to found their own spiritual communities. And a lot of people, you know, are looking for gurus, so a lot of people are taken in by it.
Yeah, there's, and that's the thing is I think when someone connects on to maybe a little bit of information that hits them emotionally, they tend to then gravitate towards that individual, that person, and that's their guru, and there's no level of discernment there, and so it can be quite a dangerous thing.
Oh yeah, it's very dangerous. Yeah, I mean, I think in some people there is an instinct to abdicate responsibility for their own lives and hand it over to a powerful guru figure.
And I think that happens in mediumship, you know.
Yeah.
That's rife in mediumship. People just cannot get on with their lives, and they have to just keep going to mediums all the time.
Oh, right.
And they're not taking responsibility, and they won't take responsibility for their lives, and so they live through a medium, and that's dangerous.
Yeah, I guess that's what we would call spiritual bypassing.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, you use spirituality as a way of evading your issues and abdicating responsibility for your life, and that happens a lot in spiritual communities. You know, where people revere the guru, and often the gurus are narcissistic people who crave and thrive on the admiration of their followers. And
attention.
So it's kind of they're both getting what they want, really.
Yeah, but it's a parasitic relationship.
Yeah, it's a toxic relationship. Always ends in disaster.
Let's talk a little bit about the ego there, because I'm fascinated with this, because you talk a lot about dissolution of the ego. And some people would then challenge you and say, well, wait a minute, don't we need the ego? Because the ego can actually be one of our greatest teachers, or yeah, it can be our greatest nemesis.
Yeah, well, I agree. You know, I'm not one of those teachers or authors who say that the ego is an enemy. It should be destroyed. The point is that, you know, there are different kinds of ego. You know, ego is basically just the Latin word for I, or the Greek word for I. And you need a sense of I to function in the world. You need some psychological processes to function. So I'm not saying that you should do away with any sense of identity. You need a kind of administrator to organize your life to function in the world.
Right.
But that's what the ego is, ideally. I think the problem is that in the ordinary state of being, the ego is like a dictator. It's like,
right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like it's taken over our whole being. Whereas ideally the ego should just be a kind of a member of a democratic government who doesn't kind of overstep his mark or her mark. Ideally, you know, the ego should just be a pure administrator who helps to plan and organize our lives, so helps us to make decisions, helps us to concentrate, but nothing more than that.
So would it be right then, I don't want to assume anything, but suggesting that the dissolution of the ego is a deeper state of awareness?
Yeah. But what happens is that when the old ego dissolves away, there is a new, you could use the term ego if you like, a new self which replaces it. It's not, some people talk about spiritual awakening as a state of no self, but I think it's more of a state of new self. You know, there's a new self which arises, which has a sense of identity, but it's a completely different identity.
That's fascinating. I it's something I actually haven't thought of myself, but I can now, you're kind of putting the pieces, you know, together with me. So, like I said at the beginning, I've always kind of fought against this idea of awakening, and I'll suggest it because I've always said, well, if we're awakening, it sounds that we're in a state of slumber. It sounds that we're in a state of sleep. But if we really are identifying with our soul, and our soul being what it is, does the soul ever sleep? So I then tended to move on to, well, is it more a self-realization, a deeper state of awareness and self, and a realization of, as if you said, the I, who you actually are, and moving from a state of knowledge to knowing?
Yeah, I mean, you could describe it in those terms. But I mean, I think I would say that it's true that we normally live in a state of sleep. I think normal human awareness is very restricted, and it's sort of, it creates an illusory image of reality. So awakening is an expansion of awareness to a wider and deeper reality. It's like blowing the doors open and allowing much more reality to flood into them. And it's kind of undoing.
That makes sense because, I mean, you know that I've never really, and this is the first guys that you're hearing about this in Deadly Departed, I've never told anybody outside of people that's close to me or in Aleph that I had a near-death experience. And it was actually written about in a magazine many, many years ago in the UK because we had a bad car accident. But what you're, and one of the reasons I've never really spoke about it since that magazine article is because I got no evidence of it, and I'm all about evidence. So when you have that something, but what you're talking about is exactly how I felt when that happened, when the accident happened, and I had this feeling of non-separation from anything, a greater sense of connectedness with everything. I think that's very, you know, it's, you know, what I wrote about before, but I think that's very important for people to realize that these experiences give you a deeper sense of connection.
Yeah. And I guess it's never, once you've had that experience, it never really leaves you, does it?
And here's the thing, like I said this when I was doing some of my writing for, you know, NLF, what was the, when I had that experience, I was already a medium. I was already working on that side. So it makes you consider, you know, was that brought on by my bias or my belief or anything else, you know, but the experience has never to this day left me. And there's been a greater sense of knowingness, knowing that the connection, there's a deep sense, like you said, there's a deep sense of connection to nature. That's what I felt. I felt such a deeper sense of connection to nature.
Yeah. It's a sense that there's something beyond the immediate physical world around us. That's not, I mean, for most people, that is the reality. But there's a sense that there is something more, you know, even if it's not really tangible, there's just an awareness that there is something more. The world is much more complex and kind of interesting than we normally perceive. And, you know, there are all kinds of phenomena and forces and realities beyond our normal awareness. We can vaguely sense them, but, you know, even if they're not tangible, we know that they're there.
Do you mind me bringing up your recent loss? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so because this is perfect, because you mentioned, you know, in one of your writings that you had, and actually I think you alluded to this in Psychology Today as well, when you recently lost your mother, and when you were in that room, you had an expansive kind of feeling. You had a sense, like, was that, I mean, not an awakening, but that connection, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, it was definitely a connection to something transcendent. My mother was in hospital. I knew she was dying, but I thought she had a bit more time left, so I wasn't actually with her at the time she died. But I arrived about an hour after she had passed.
Right.
And I just sat with her body. I sat with her body for an hour or two or longer. And while I was sitting with her body, just me and her in a private room in the hospital, this kind of white radiance began to fill the room. It seemed to sort of emanate from her or around her. And everything in the room, all the objects in the room began to fade away. Well, it was almost as if they were sort of engulfed by this white radiance. So everything was just shimmering with this beautiful white radiance. And it seemed to immerse me or pervade me. My whole being seemed to be filled with it. I had this sense that I was no longer separate from the scene. You know, it was a really beautiful, powerful experience. Kind of difficult to describe because it was so sort of out of the ordinary. But my sense of separateness just dissolved away. You know, I was part of the room, part of this white radiance. And I had the sense that, you know, this was coming from some sort of portal had opened. And I was experiencing some transcendent reality, which is always there, but it's just beyond my normal experience. And obviously it was connected with her death. I don't exactly know how, but it was definitely a sense that, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. So it was really,
do you think that, so I'll give you a little example, and it made me think of this. And just when I was thinking about us having our meeting, so yesterday I was asked to go and a lot of the times in my work, I often get asked to go and pray with the dying and to go by their bedside. It could be families. And it's often people that they've fallen away from religion, or they've been frightened of religion, or they've been, and so the families they're experiencing things. And so anyway, I got into the situation. I was asked to go to this beautiful place in North Carolina. The woman who was getting to the end of her life, her name's Miriam, pancreatic cancer. And as I was in there, they asked me if I would do a prayer, if I would spend some time. And I did. You know, I'm a spiritualist minister, so I did my thing. And I was there with the carers and the family members, and we did that. And one of the things I kind of thought about was, this is a potential catalyst to awakening of the people that are actually in the room, and not necessarily the person who's gone through the dying process. So I don't know if that's anything that you've ever come across or touched, but I have a feeling that, I mean, there was two people in there. I thought, you know what, they're primed for it. The way that I could feel from them, they're primed for a really deep awakening. And they were already starting to question what religion or what was teaching them or anything else, or they had, you know, maybe they were spiritual but not religious, had fallen away into that identity, if you like. But it seemed like to me that those that are in a caring position, whether it's, you know, holistic carers, nurses, their catalyst could be the administering to the dying individual.
Oh yeah, definitely. That kind of portal between life and death is such a powerful place where, you know, all kinds of transformations can occur, all kinds of anomalous experiences can occur, and they do occur. You know, I've written blogs recently about near-death experiences, also after-death communications, crisis apparitions, terminal lucidity. And I think a lot of people do experience transformations through encountering death in other people and also in themselves when they themselves come close to passing away.
Have you came across anybody that's had that experience? That's actually, you can see, you know, the loss of their loved one awakened them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I actually published a paper about three or four years ago. I did a study of 16 people who'd experienced transformation through bereavement. And yeah, they a lot of people, almost everybody I spoke to, had this radical transformation. And in some cases, it was partly due to after-death communications, which right. sort of changed their view of reality. In some cases, it was simply that, you know, the shock and the stress of losing somebody they were so close to and how that can change your life and bring your life into a state of upheaval. But yeah, it's very common. It's definitely one of the most common areas where transformation occur. And yeah, it often is because so many people experience after-death communications, you know, and once you have them, you know they're real, and that yes. changes your view of reality. You know, it makes you realize that death is not the end. And that realization in itself is transformation.
I have another podcast called Pillars of Grief, so shameless plug. I'll need to get you on that because it's relatively right. new, but we talk about grief and it's been doing really well. But here's one of the things that has been really fascinating with me. I also run a grief group, and I have people there who are lost their loved ones through COVID, etc. And people that I talk to or message me, their after-death communication or the evidence they receive from the other side, it actually causes a little bit more trauma to them, because if they've been indoctrinated into a particular religious belief system or, you know, Christianity or whatever it is, where they put a kibosh on, as an example, I had a dream, and I'm not going to go for it because we're not meant to dream. We're told by our pastors, we're not meant to dream, or that's a bad thing. And so they get into this whole psychological, a mental imbalance, if you like, causes them to severe anxiety. They've just experienced something wonderful. They've had an after-death communication, and yet it puts them into further trauma because of their religious connection or the religious attachment.
Yeah, that's true. I've heard cases of the parents of children who were obviously showing signs of a previous incarnation or giving reports of their previous lives that were so convincing that the parents had to take them seriously. But if the parents were Christians, then they, you know, they resisted them or were just sort of shocked by them. But I think in most cases, people eventually do accept the reality, even if it contradicts their religion.
Yeah.
A friend of mine died just about 2 months ago, actually, of cancer. And he was from a Muslim background. His father was quite a strict Muslim who brought him up in a very strict way.
Right.
But he, you know, even before he passed away recently, he had a near-death experience when he was young. And obviously, you know, if you're a Muslim, near-death experiences, you know, kind of don't make much sense, or they're not really acceptable. But he knew, even though he was religious, he knew that it was so real that he had to take it seriously. So he kind of moved away from his religious background because, you know, often these experiences do show people that the kind of the conventional religion that they're told about may not be valid. You know, it may not explain reality. So sometimes, you know, it does precipitate a move away from religion.
Why do you think a religion, why do you think religious organizations do not embrace it? knowing full well that it, like, for example, the Catholic Church says they never use, they don't use mediums or anything else, but we know for a fact that they actually, you know, it does say that, if somebody has the gifts of the Spirit, they don't say mediums, but they'll say the gifts of the Spirit. Why do you think then that these religious organizations are not, I mean, they're not supportive of your work, Extraordinary Awakenings. That's a no-no because that puts them out of job. But why do you think they're like that? They're not embracing the reality that we are spiritual beings.
Well, yeah, I think there's always been a kind of disjunct between conventional religion and esoteric phenomena ever since the church was established, you know, in the 16th century. You know, mystics have always been excommunicated and executed. Anybody who questions the dogma. I mean, religions, you know, degenerate into dogma, into rigid dogma. Mm. And it's all bound up with power as well. It's bound up with the authority of certain individuals and organizations. So when people contradict the dogma, it undermines their authority, and they feel threatened. Also, the worldview which they've, this dogmatic worldview, which they've accepted as reality, is threatened by, you know, anomalous phenomena. So, yeah, it's a
shame.
That
sounds like, is that like the, I haven't read it yet, but is that like a kind of idea of your Disconnected book that you've just released?
So how do you mean? Which idea?
Is it, so you're talking about, you know, this disconnection they have between religion or the dogma and everything else. And so is this something, because you've just recently brought out, which I haven't read yet, which I need, it's on my list. The new book, Disconnected, is that kind of similar? Does that cover that kind of theory?
Yeah, to a degree. Yeah, it's linked to it. Yeah, I talk about how true spirituality is about connection.
Yes.
You know, it's about connection to other people, to other living beings, to nature, connection to your own deeper self, connection to a wider wider realms of reality. Whereas disconnection is about, you know, it's about living within a narrow egoic perspective. And often that's associated with dogma and ideology. Ideologies always disconnect people. Ideology is like a sort of prison of the mind. You know, once you absorb an ideology, you can't really see outside it, and you interpret everything in terms of that ideology.
So, which is like one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, I think truly spiritual people are always open-minded because they don't carry ideologies.
Right.
You know, they don't need beliefs. I like it when somebody asked. I think it was Eckhart Tolle when he was interviewed by Oprah. She said to him, "So, what do you believe about the world? You know, what do you really believe about reality?" And he said, I don't believe anything."
That's kind of, it's the kind of thing I say, I don't believe anything. I've been on a lot of radio shows and I say, I don't believe in the afterlife. I know there's an afterlife. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, but beliefs, you know, they're really a kind of, they just offer support for the ego, really, you know.
Would you say they're temporary? Because I think beliefs change, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there are different kinds of beliefs. You can have a belief which is based on evidence. Like, I mean, if you ask me about the afterlife, I would say I'm pretty sure there is an afterlife based on the evidence.
Pretty sure. That's good. I like that.
Well, I'm certain. Like I say, I'm certain because of the evidence.
I know. I love it. So, I mean, beliefs change. I lost your signal there a little minute ago. As I was saying, that do you think beliefs change? Because it seems to me that if you believe in something, there's room for interpretation. And I've noticed that some people, I believe in this and then I don't. I believe in something else, and they move to something else.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I guess you could say that if a person is open-minded, then their beliefs will change. It's when people's beliefs don't change. That's more of a problem, I think, when people are stuck to a rigid ideology. You know, if a belief is based on evidence, you know, then it should change according to people's experiences and different forms of evidence. So that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Do you think belief drops away like the dissolution of the ego when you have an awakening experience?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think once people undergo awakening, they don't need beliefs because everything that they think or feel is based on experience. So, once you have experience, you don't need beliefs, you know, and your worldview becomes informed purely by your experience rather than through belief.
And then I think it's very important to say that people who have these real experiences don't necessarily force them upon anybody else, because they've had their experience and they'll just say, this is what I've experienced, and you know, you can at some point, you know, accept it or not accept it.
Yeah, that's true. Some people feel an idealistic or altruistic desire to help other people and to sort of share their wisdom, which is fine. Like I know a guy who had this amazing near death experience several years ago, and ever since then he's just so full of kind of joy, and he wants to share it with other people. He wants to share his new perspective on reality with others and help others by making them realize that the world is more beautiful and life is more meaningful than they realize. But yeah, they don't want to convert anybody. You know, they just want to share the joy and the wisdom that they've gained.
Do you think there's a lot of interpretation for a lot of the NDEs that are out there? Like, for instance, there's some, I would say, people that claim that they have NDEs, and you kind of just know that that's not real. They never really had that NDE.
I'm not sure, really. I've not really met, I've not met many people like that. But I guess, you know...
See, for me, Steve, if somebody's got an NDE, they should have evidence. And yeah. And maybe that's a weakness in me. Maybe that's because I'm always looking for evidence and evidential truth. Mm. So I always think, which is one of the reasons I didn't really talk about the experience I had, because I had no evidence other than seeing what happened above the truck and being able to say what happened and, you know, as it was.
Yeah.
I never had any evidence to prove it to anyone. So I'm always very skeptical of, and I hate to say it, you know, even as a medium, I'm very skeptical of maybe 80% of these the people that claim there's NDEs, because I'm always looking for an evidential trail. Yet when I come across a case where there's, wow, that's evidence, that will make me sit up and take note, and that will make me want to know more.
Right.
So is this a possible imbalance where maybe the ego's coming forward and it's not really an NDE?
Possibly, yeah. Maybe people are seeking attention or sort of deluding themselves. You know, human beings do have quite a strong tendency to delude themselves in certain circumstances. But I think if somebody has had a genuine NDE, then you'll always know. You'll always sense it, because NDEs are probably the single most transformational experience which human beings can have. Yeah. They change human beings more radically than any other experience. And more, you know, a lot of people go through a diagnosis of cancer, but only a small minority of people undergo a transformation as a result of that. A lot of people go through the experience of addiction. Only a small minority undergo transformation through that experience. But with NDEs, almost everybody undergoes a radical transformation. So I guess you can always tell whether people will manifest that transformation or those characteristics in their life. You know,
are they living their life like that?
Sorry?
Are they living their life according
to their new transformation? Yeah, are they living their life? Are they more altruistic, less materialistic? Do they live with a sense of joy? Have they become more intuitive and more creative? Yeah, I mean, the guy I mentioned earlier, a guy called David, who underwent a near-death experience about 10 years ago now. It was an amazing experience. I won't go into all the details, but it was when he was seeing a friend off on the train. He went onto the train to help her with the luggage. As he was getting off, his coat got stuck in the doors of the train as they shut. And the train actually set off with his coat trapped in the doors. He was pulled along the platform at high speed and eventually was sort of sucked under the train. And it was a terrible experience, but it was the single most important experience of his life. But since then, he's become an artist. You know, he's become a musician. He's composed a symphony to kind of depict his near-death experience.
And he never had any skills in that field before he had the experience.
No, he did some sort of sketching, but he wasn't an artist. He hadn't done painting, and he sort of played guitar in a punk band, but he hadn't composed symphonies. You know, people who have NDEs, they do manifest these amazing new abilities and new characteristics. So, you know, you need to,
You need to learn to discern.
I think we have a kind of instinctive discernment about these things, I think.
And it's, I think it's important for the public to learn to discern it as well, to not to be duped by, you know, false gurus and that, all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. It's good to be discerning.
What's been the probably the best case that you've ever come across that you would say, you know, that has all the markings of your what your book's all about?
I think the most inspiring case is a woman called Eve, who is from Edinburgh. She lives in Edinburgh, in Scotland. And she was a really severe addict, really severe alcoholic. She started drinking at the age of 11 and was already an alcoholic by the time she was 15 or 16. And, you know, she functioned fairly well for a number of years, but eventually, as is always the case with addiction, you know, her life began to fall apart. And she, you know, she couldn't hold down a job. Her friends began to distrust her and break contact with her. And she lived a really sort of chaotic, violent life. You know, she was always getting into trouble with the police, trouble with men. And eventually, when she was 42, her drinking was so severe that, you know, she was drinking, she said she was drinking 12 bottles of wine a day, and she was shoplifting all the time to kind of fund her habit. And she eventually became homeless. She was living on the streets in Edinburgh. And she'd tried to stop drinking before, but had never managed it. So she felt that she was in a hopeless situation. She was so physically broken down, she could only walk a few paces and she'd have to sort of sit down or lie down. So she decided she had no option but to commit suicide, to kill herself. And so she waited for the coach. She knew that there was a coach going from Edinburgh to Glasgow at a certain time, kind of the National Express bus.
Mm.
So she waited and just jumped out in front of the coach to try to kill herself. But luckily the driver swerved, so she survived. And then the police came, and she thought she was going to get arrested and taken to the station. But the policeman was actually a really nice guy, she said. And the policeman said, you know, how did you end up in this situation? Can I help you somewhere? So she said, oh, just take me to my parents. And she hadn't seen her parents for a long time because they were so disenchanted with her alcoholism.
Yeah.
But the policeman took her to her parents' house and her parents took her in. And her mum, soon after she arrived, her mother said to her, okay, well, you're an alcoholic. I suppose I'll have to give you a drink, won't I? So her mum poured her a glass of wine and she picked up the wine, but she couldn't drink it. She just put it down against her head, picked it up, put it down, picked it up, put it down. She couldn't physically drink it. It was as if another person was sort of putting it down on her behalf.
Mm.
And then she said she looked in the mirror and she said, who is that person? Yeah, I don't recognize that person. She'd undergone some sort of shift and didn't know who she was anymore. So anyway, then a doctor arrived and gave her some medication to sort of knock her out for a while to deal with the withdrawal symptoms. And when she came to, she realized that she was a different person, that she had no desire to drink. The craving for alcohol had just disappeared. Despite like 29 years of drinking. And she had this new sense of contentment, this new sense of kind of ease and a feeling of connection to other people and connection to nature.
Mm.
So she basically underwent a full psychic transformation.
Now, it's interesting, Steve. I love that story, and I'll tell you why. Because when that came, my wife, you know, we were driving, Joe and I were driving down the road, and we're listening to that story. And the both of us at the same time turned around and said, that's been an intervention. We were like, okay, that's either been, whether you believe, you know, spirit guide or a spirit from the other side or a spiritual intervention from maybe a discarnate being that has, whether it's an angelic intervention, that was a beautiful story. And it's something that impacted us that we sat with that for a while and thought, okay, that has to have been in our experience, it had to have been a spiritual intervention by...
Possibly, because
you mentioning, look, you can't, she couldn't put her, the, you know, every time she tried to put the drink or, you know, there was a force there that was stopping her. We look at no proof of it, but isn't it amazing to think that maybe we have that guide or that being that's watching over us, that maybe she got to that point where she had just cried out from the depths of her soul, wanted to take her life, and then boom, she gets the intervention and the awakening.
Mm. Possibly, yeah. That's one way of looking at it. I mean, I do speculate in the book about why these transformations occur, and it is almost like a kind of possession, like some
yeah.
a new identity enters somebody's being and becomes their new
yes.
self. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. Yeah. The strange thing is that many people said to me that they felt like they were a different person inhabiting the same body. Everything was so different. You know, they felt different. Everything looked different. They just had the same body. And I remember one person telling me that she went back to her hometown about 6 months after her transformation. And people were saying, oh, hi, how are you? And she thought, who are these people? How do they know me? Everything seemed so different that she was surprised.
Dissolution, isn't it? Dissolution of the ego and everything. I didn't even know her.
Yeah, that's right. So it is a radical transformation. Maybe, who knows? Maybe there is, you know, that is one possible way of explaining it.
I think that's certainly for me and Joe, that I like to think that way. I think there's something comforting in that. I wouldn't want anybody to get to the point where they get to want to take their own lives. I mean, you know, that's another show. But, you know, just to have the fact to know, and even in that story exemplifies, you're not alone. You're looked after. And, when you cry out from your soul, you are going to be answered. You are going to be helped. And I do think I do think it's a possibility that was a spirit intervention or obsession or however, people want to take that. But I think it's a beautiful, and it is one of the best stories in your book.
Yeah. It's a miracle, really, how an addiction can fall away. And I found many cases where people have been carrying drug or alcohol addictions for many, many years, really severe ones, and they just fall away. You know, so the only way of explaining it is that it's a new identity which doesn't carry those addictions. The addictions died away with the previous identity, which disappeared. So there's a fresh new self, doesn't carry any addictions and doesn't carry any of the trauma.
Obviously, Carl Wicklund's book, 30 Years Among the Dead, an old, old book from way back in the day, kind of postulates that, people can be inhabited by spirits. And that maybe, so let's suggest then, before we finish, that could it be that those who are under the influence of, drugs and alcohol are actually being influenced by infiltrating spirits, and that the awakening is the removal, if you like, of the infiltrating force, the possessive being, the possessive spirit, right? I know it's taking a new angle, but
that's another way of looking at it. I guess it's feasible. Yeah.
How does that sit with you as a psychologist?
It's feasible. You know, I'm fascinated by reincarnation, where identities seem to inhabit people from previous lives, and there's a kind of conflict between the identity a person has in this life and their previous identity. And
Have you seen that Ghosts in My Children on Netflix?
I don't think so.
Oh, go and watch it, Steve.
Ghosts in My Children.
Yeah, and it's about reincarnation. But these stories are absolutely fascinating, and they have all the hallmarks and really, really, really strong evidence. I mean, phenomenal evidence where the kid's actually able to identify the person they worked with in 9/11 in the tower.
Oh, really?
By name.
Yeah. Yeah, did you see the Netflix series Surviving Death?
Yes. Yeah, Leslie Keane brought that out.
One episode on reincarnation.
You would enjoy that one, because it's all the stories of the kids' reincarnation. And how it's like an awakening, because they don't get their normal life here again until they go through some kind of transformation, some kind of awakening. There's been Native American prayers and intercessions that have helped them. And it's just fascinating, because the evidence, the trail of evidence in it, is just beyond reproach.
Yeah, yeah. There's a guy called Jim Tucker.
He's from Virginia.
Yeah, yeah. He's doing some excellent work. So carrying on from the work of Ian Stevenson.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I think the evidence for reincarnation is beyond dispute now.
It is. I don't think there's any skeptic could actually find and pick holes in it. Although they try,
I'm sure they will.
Anyway,
they always find some way of explaining it away.
It's been absolutely a pleasure having you on. What's for you now? Have you got another book coming out? You're working on more because you're a prolific writer.
I've got next year. I've actually got two books coming out next year. I've got a book a book in January called The Adventure, with the subtitle A Practical Guide for Spiritual Awakening, and I've got a book later in the year, which is called Time Expansion Experiences, about time expansion experiences when time slows down radically in like accidents or psychedelic experiences.
My credit card's going to get hit now.
Well, I don't think they're able to buy yet, so you're safe for a while.
That's awesome. I mean, you love writing. I see. I mean, you've got loads of books out there, and I've, you know, I will put in the description where people can get your books. I wholly recommend them, especially if you want to study transpersonal psychology. And you can also catch Steve. What university do you work? You work at Leeds University and the Aleph Trust.
Leeds Beckett University.
Leeds Beckett University, and you're a tutor at the Aleph Trust as well.
Yeah,
which is an awesome organization.
It is.
Steve, would you come on the Pillars of Grief podcast as well and be a guest on there? Let's talk about grief and psychology of grief as well. I think that's a really important show. There's a lot of people listening to that.
I'd be glad to. Yeah.
I've thoroughly enjoyed having you on here. What's the final word that you can leave for people about your work with Extraordinary Awakenings, your book here, that you want to say to people?
I would say that never underestimate the powers of the human spirit. There are amazing reserves of resilience and amazing depths of experience within us that we only really become aware of in when we are challenged or when we face crises.
That's beautiful. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Deadly Departed. This is Steve Taylor. You can connect with him. What's your website, Steve? SteveTaylor.com?
It's StephenMTaylor.com. There's so many Steve Taylors around.
Stephen M. Taylor. Taylor.com. And is that just the website? Are you connected? Obviously, you're on Twitter as well.
Yeah, if you go to my website, you'll find my social media, like, you know, Twitter and Facebook and etc.
Sign up for his newsletter. His newsletter is awesome. Go get the books. And listen, if you've had an awakening experience, you want to share it with us and you've listened to this podcast, then or if you've watched us on YouTube, then send us in the question. Send us your example. Send us your experiences, because we'd love to know more about your experiences, because when you share experiences, that's how we all learn, that's how we all grow, and that's how we all develop. So
that's true.
This is Deadly Departed. Thank you for being with us, and you will get Steve back here again next time, or you'll certainly catch him on Pillars of Grief. God bless. Hi there, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. If you have purchased Deadly Departed, it means a lot to me. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for supporting my work. And if you haven't bought Deadly Departed yet, then consider buying Deadly Departed. You can get it on Amazon, or you can get it in any bookstore, and you can show proof of purchase and join my closed group. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at any time at Spiritual Medium if you have a question, and I will answer it. Have a wonderful day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you once again. God bless.
You've been listening to Deadly Departed with renowned evidential medium and author Jock Brocas.
Jock Brocas.
If you like what you've heard, make sure to pick up a copy of the Deadly Departed book. Don't forget to share the episodes and send in your questions to us about anything paranormal and the afterlife. Tune in next time to Deadly Departed, the do's, don'ts, and dangers of afterlife communication.